This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
...of marine animals.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 22nd, 2013. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. One of the owners of the newly opened Portland Aquarium faces federal charges for illegal trafficking of marine animals. Eamon Covino owns another aquarium in Idaho where he and his company secretary were arrested yesterday after a Florida grand jury charged the two with conspiracy to violate the Lacey Act. According to court documents, Covino and his secretary purchased four spotted eagle rays and two lemon sharks for approximately $6,300. The Florida grand jury claims the fish were illegally harvested from federal waters without permits. Court documents also say Covino tried to obtain lemon sharks for the Portland facility, but his brother and co-owner Vince Covino says that they currently have no lemon sharks or spotted rays on display.
Portland police arrested one protester in Pier Park today as city workers cut down a giant sequoia tree. The protest today was part of an ongoing fight to save the tree. Portland Parks and Recreation says they had to remove the tree to make room for a long-planned bike path and bridge. Yesterday, three local women stood in the way of chainsaws despite being threatened with arrest. Today, less than a dozen protesters and eight police officers were on site when city crews began to trim and prep the sequoia. Dennis Keeps, who worked to save the tree, estimates that it was about 18 feet in diameter, 120 feet tall, and 80 to 100 years old.
In a follow-up to a story we reported yesterday on the KBOO News, political prisoner Rashid Johnson remains in a precarious situation at the Snake River Prison in eastern Oregon. A fellow prisoner wrote a letter on February 11th saying that the prison authorities were, quote, trying to kill, end quote, Johnson. They had allegedly slipped something into his food, and Johnson had been acting bizarrely since then, refusing to eat or drink and ingesting 30 pills and three razor blades. The letter said that Johnson has received no medical treatment or response from prison authorities. Today, one of his supporters reported that a prison spokesperson confirmed only that Johnson is still alive, but would not provide any further information. Supporter Victor Wallace spoke with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg.
The information that we received, I guess, is what has gone out across the internet, which is that he hasn't eaten anything since February 3rd.
That was as of February the 11th. Now, whether he has started to eat again since then, I don't know. I know absolutely nothing about him since what was said in that letter.
And what's been the response from prison authorities?
They're basically stonewalling us, and they say that in order to give out any information, they need to have him fill out a form giving his approval. So we're trying to get lawyers into the act to demand that this be taken care of so that the information can be gotten out.
Have any lawyers been able to reach him at Snake River?
Not yet, but we've made some contacts, and I believe that some lawyers from Portland may try to call him on Monday, and we're hoping perhaps someone who can visit him who's not so far away, perhaps a lawyer from Bend, who might be able to go and visit him early next week, because apparently even a lawyer calling into the prison will have difficulty reaching him or finding anything out. The authorities are very, they're keeping everything tight and not letting any information out.
Can you give our listeners a little background about Rashid Johnson?
He's in his early 40s now. He's been in prison for more than 20 years. He has a little autobiographical essay in the book of his that came out in 2010 called Defying the Tomb, which I strongly recommend to people who are interested in his story. I would say that he was a rebel from the outset. In his autobiographical essay, he described his confrontations with the police, which eventually landed him in prison for long term. But it was all in the context of a kind of approach to working on behalf of the neighborhood. And he was incarcerated all those many years until just a year ago in a supermax in Virginia. And then because of all the conflicts surrounding him, the Virginia authorities decided to ship him to Oregon. In Oregon, he was at first placed in the state prison in Salem in the general population for the first time. And it was as a result of his organizing activities there, essentially, that, after 5 months that he was shipped, then this would be last August or September, to Snake River. And Rashid is definitely committed to working and socializing across racial lines in the prison, which has been one of the causes of his problems in Oregon. And in Snake River, he was put in isolation. He was put in what they call the intensive management unit. So, and he's also been, since beginning of September, prohibited from making any phone calls. So his communication has been entirely by mail.
And is there anything that our listeners can do if they want to get involved or if they want to support Rashid or other political prisoners?
Definitely. One thing, there's a number to call, and you'll probably just get an answering machine, but it's still worth leaving your concern and complaint so that they know that a lot of people are following this. The number is 503-378-6188.
And what is that number?
It's a number of some office in the state prison system. It's not a Snake River number. It's a number of the general state prison administration that has to do, apparently, just from their answering machine, it sounds like, especially with transfers of prisoners. But we were told by a lawyer in Portland that that was the best number to call.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us, and we will keep checking in for updates about Rashid Johnson in Eastern Oregon, an inmate at Snake River Correctional Institution. Again, I've been speaking with Victor Wallace, a supporter of Rashid. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
This week, Florida Atlantic University, FAU, announced a deal to rename its football stadium after the GEO Group, one of the largest private prison companies in the world. Today, details emerged on GEO Group's attempts to cover up a history of human rights abuses on Wikipedia. On Wednesday, after the naming rights deal became public, a Wikipedia editor named Abraham Cohen, the name of a GEO Group spokesman, deleted the entire controversies section of the firm's Wikipedia article, replacing it with propaganda. The section has since been restored. GEO Chairman George Soley and several other employees in the ranks are alumni of FAU. This has led Huffington Post Chris Kirkham to wonder if there is a potential ulterior motive for GEO's $6 million deal with FAU. Kirkham said, quote, "For the last three election cycles, the GEO Group has donated more than $1.2 million to the Florida Republican Party. Republicans in the state legislature last year nearly approved a massive expansion of private prisons in South Florida, a deal that the GEO Group mentioned frequently in calls with investors," unquote. GEO and university officials claim the deal is strictly philanthropic.
The Oregon House of Representatives today passed a bill allowing immigrant students who grew up in Oregon to receive in-state tuition for college. The bill, known as Tuition Equity, now goes to the state Senate, where it's expected to pass. Young people without documentation will then be allowed to attend public universities in Oregon with their peers without having to worry about paying out-of-state tuition rates. Those rates are often three times as high as the in-state tuition rate for Oregon residents, which would make college a financial impossibility for many of these high school graduates. The bill is supported by the leadership at all of Oregon's public universities and was introduced by Democrats in the House of Representatives. But it has bipartisan support despite previous attempts by Republican legislatures to block the passage of tuition equity bills.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30. At 6, Bread and Roses presents a new series, Women, Money, and Empowerment, Taking Responsibility for Finances, Taking Control of Destiny. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, News, Views, and Hip Hop. The weather, rainy, with high temperatures around 50 degrees through the weekend.
It's 5:12, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
With all the woes that we humans have inflicted on our weary old Earth, from the reckless plundering of her resources to the self-destructive tampering with her climate, perhaps it's time we give her a break. What, you want us to cut back on our fracking, ransacking, scorched earth ways? No, of course not. I merely mean that the good Earth is getting a bit, shall we say, depleted. So, to maintain our insatiable appetite for devouring our own environment, shouldn't we be seeking greener pastures to exploit? Good news, our scientists are already on top of it. At the 221st annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society in January, all the buzz was about drastically ramping up the flow of tax dollars into sky surveys to detect and analyze, quote, near-Earth asteroids. It seems that some 20,000 of these hulking chunks of rock, ice, and who knows what are orbiting around our solar system. Yet only 6,000 of them have been identified. The professional sky watchers say that at the current pace of detecting and probing this plethora of asteroids zipping around and at us, not only are we in grave danger of being smacked by some, but we're also missing one heck of an economic opportunity, for there's gold in them thar skies. With dollars in their eyes, several astronomers predict that many asteroids contain rich veins of platinum, cobalt, zinc, and other valuable metals, as well as such essential human needs as oxygen and hydrogen. Let's go get it, is their exuberant cry. First, they demand, fund us and our technological probes to find out what's in each chunk of space stuff, then finance manned missions to harvest the goodies. This is Jim Hightower saying, how fracking wonderful is this? Our expertise at exploitation of natural resources need not be earthbound. We have it within us to mess up the whole cosmos.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. government's civil case against British Petroleum for the 2010 oil spill disaster is scheduled to go to trial Monday in New Orleans. But there's also the possibility that the oil company will settle with the government. John Kostiak with the National Wildlife Federation says it's imperative that any penalty against BP must be high enough to make sure another spill doesn't happen.
Department of Justice has a responsibility to set a penalty amount that factors in BP's assets, which we know are nearly $300 billion, and the risk that they will continue business as usual if their bottom line is not affected by any settlement.
The Deepwater Horizon disaster in 2010 leaked an estimated 170 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, making it the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history. Nearly 3 years after the spill, the full impact still isn't known, according to Brian Moore with the National Audubon Society.
The people of the Gulf do not feel like justice has yet been served. The damage caused to the environment is significant, and much needs to be done.
The first phase of the trial will focus on the causes of the disaster and who should be held responsible. In November, BP reached a $4.5 billion criminal settlement with the Justice Department. Just last week, Transocean, the contractor that owned the Deepwater Horizon oil rig, settled criminal charges for violating the Clean Water Act. Attorney General Eric Holder says the $400 million settlement will go toward protecting, restoring, and rebuilding the Gulf Coast region.
The case against five former employees from the private security firm formerly known as Blackwater has crumbled after the defendant said they were acting at the behest of the CIA. Former Blackwater President Gary Jackson and four others were indicted in 2010 for a list of felony gun violations involving dozens of weapons. These included 17 M4 military assault rifles and 17 Romanian-made AK-47s. All charges against three of the accused were dismissed Thursday at the prosecutor's request. This follows a federal judge's ruling earlier this month that reduced several of the felony charges to misdemeanors. According to the defendants, they were working for the CIA when they provided five guns as gifts to King Abdullah II of Jordan. Under a plea agreement, Jackson and former company vice president William Matthews admitted guilt Thursday on misdemeanor charges related to record-keeping violations. The company has to pay just $5,000 in fines. The two top executives had originally faced decades in prison on 12 felony charges.
This coming Monday in the small United Kingdom town of Horsham, a lawsuit will be heard that challenges the official version of the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. The lawsuit charges the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, with aiding and abetting terrorism by concealing information which would show problems with the official version of the events on 9/11. The defendant is a British resident who refused to pay his television fee after the BBC aired two documentaries upholding the official version of the 9/11 attacks. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Richard, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this lawsuit that's being heard on Monday by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth against the BBC in Britain.
One of the citizens in the UK who has to pay a licensing fee to fund the BBC has refused to do so because there is a law in the UK, as in the US here, that you can't aid and abet terrorism or provide funds for aiding and abetting terrorism. And Tony Rook's concern is that by covering up the truth about what happened on 9/11 in their documentaries, he has been given 3 hours in the UK in a courtroom, a court of law, to present the evidence why the BBC is complicit in the cover-up of the truth about 9/11. So we have provided evidence from the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There's 1,700 of us now signed on to a petition demanding a real investigation of what happened on 9/11 at the Twin Towers. Many people don't know, for instance, that there's a third skyscraper that was destroyed on 9/11, and Architects and Engineers are floored when they see the video of this building dropping at freefall acceleration straight down uniformly, symmetrically into its own footprint in just under 7 seconds. This is extraordinary. We've all seen it before on TV. It's a classic controlled demolition. And yet we're told by our government, NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, in a report that came out finally about 8 years later, that this came down, this building came down by normal office fires. So we know that that is not true. And there were a few fires in this building, but they're scattered and small and few and far between. And fires have never brought down a skyscraper. So we're demanding a real investigation based not only on the evidence from videos, but the evidence found by FEMA and documented in their report in May of 2002, evidence for the melting of steel, iron, molten iron invading the steel, sulfur, hot sulfur corrosion attack invading the steel, partially evaporated beams. All of these require temperatures that are twice that of the capability of hydrocarbon fires or normal office fires. So where does that come from? Well, molten iron is the byproduct of thermite. Thermite is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And there's evidence of molten iron not only under the pile of Building 7, but under the Twin Towers as well, in pools of molten iron. There's molten iron found throughout the World Trade Center dust, documented small iron droplets, and this is also the evidence of thermite. It carries the signature elements of thermite also. So we've got to have a real investigation and a real explanation of this scientific forensic evidence, as well as a reexamination of the videos of the collapse of the Twin Towers, because what we're told is the upper 12 stories in the case of the North Tower drove the North Tower down to the ground, and what really happens is in the videos is very clearly quite different. It is destroyed in what could only be described as a miniature controlled demolition in the first 4 seconds. After that, what's happening is a series of explosions, which are documented by over 100 first responders, but this is not included in the official reports.
And what will then be the impact if a judge sees this evidence and sees it as the BBC aiding and abetting terrorism?
Well, it could be enormous. That's what we're hoping for, an awakening in the court system, the political system, and through the public, of the reality that we have been duped, and that the media in the U.S. as well as the U.K. has been complicit in this scam of epic proportions. When the American people and the British people awaken to the realities, I think there will be nothing short of a change in government, ultimately. That's not my aim, but I can only imagine that people will be very angry to have been deceived at such a massive scale.
Again, I have been speaking with Richard Gage, who is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Hundreds of Palestinian, Israeli, and international activists demonstrated in the West Bank city of Hebron today in a push to reopen a major market area. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Israeli security forces injured more than 20 people with tear gas canisters and rubber-coated steel bullets during clashes with protesters. FSRN's Lena Odegaard was there and files this report.
In a campaign to reopen Hebron's former main market street, activists marched through the old city. Issa Amro is coordinator of the Palestinian group Youth Against Settlements.
We are here to ask to reopen Shuhada Street, which was closed before 19 years, and to remember the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre, where 29 Palestinians were killed by an Israeli retired soldier. And because of that massacre, they closed Shuhada Street, they closed all the markets in Hebron, and they closed many Palestinian apartments. So they destroyed the economy.
In a chaotic scene, protesters were met with tear gas and sound bombs from Israeli military, while young Palestinian men hurled rocks. One journalist was injured and taken away in an ambulance by Palestinian medics. Lena Odgor, FSRN, Hebron.
Israeli forces attacked hundreds of Palestinian protesters at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Old Jerusalem today. The protest took place after noon prayers at the historic mosque, in solidarity with the 800-plus Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike in Israeli custody. The 800 prisoners went on hunger strike 2 days ago to support Samer al-Essawi, who is on the 212th day of a hunger strike and is near death, according to his lawyers. The Israeli troops opened fire on the marching protesters from the roof of the mosque with concussion grenades and tear gas. At least 15 people were injured and dozens more were treated for tear gas inhalation. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is considered to be the third holiest site in Islam, located near the Dome of the Old Rock in Old Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. The protest at the mosque was just one of dozens of protests that took place this afternoon across the West Bank in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. For a report on the nonviolent protests across the West Bank today, we go to reporters Salam Kamsia and Hassan Banura with the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Protests this week were organized in solidarity with hunger-striking Palestinian political prisoners held by Israel. In southern West Bank, Israeli troops attacked the protesters in Hebron Old City and in Al-Ma'sar near Bethlehem with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. As a result, Palestinians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In Al-Ma'sar village, troops attacked the protest before it even left the village. In Hebron, the protests were organized in a Shuhada street in the Old City part. The Israeli army closed the street and cased Palestinians working there to shut their shops to provide what they call security for settlers living in illegal settlement next to the street. In central West Bank, Israeli soldiers also attacked the anti-war protests organized on Friday at the villages of Bil'in, Na'lin and Nabi Saleh. Israeli troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to suppress the three protests as well. The villagers and their international and Israeli supporters managed to reach the wall in Bil'in and Na'lin villages. But at Nabi Saleh, protesters were attacked by Israeli soldiers at the village entrance. Elsewhere in the northern West Bank village of Kfar Kadum, Israeli soldiers attacked the anti-war and settlements protesters with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. According to residents, many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. For IMEMC News, this is Salam Khumsi.
The solidarity protests with hunger-striking political detainees held by Israel were organized in the northern West Bank cities of Nablus and Jenin, in addition to Ramallah City, central West Bank, as well as Hebron and Bethlehem cities, southern West Bank. Protest tents were also set up inside main cities by families of prisoners and activists. The Israeli army mainly used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to suppress the protests. However, at the Ofer military detention center near Ramallah, unarmed protesters were met with Israeli army live gunfire. Currently, there are four prisoners on hunger strike. Samer al-Isawi on hunger strike for 215 days, Ayman Sharawna on strike for 30 days, and Ja'far Izzeddin and Tariq Ka'dan for 89 days each. They all demand to be freed or they will continue their hunger strike. Muhammad is Ja'far Izzeddin's brother.
We're very worried about Ja'far's life. He keeps fainting and suffers from constant headaches. We're sending a message to all the free people in the world that our political detainees held by the occupation, and especially those on hunger strike, they only want their freedom, which is their right. The occupation did not charge them with anything and did not formally accuse them of doing anything.
Al-Isawi was sentenced on Thursday by the Israeli District Court in Jerusalem to 8 months imprisonment starting from the date of his arrest on July 7, 2012. Al-Isawi is still facing the possibility of a long-term imprisonment that could be instated by the Israeli military court. Also this week, 800 Palestinian political detainees in three different army detention centers in Israel announced on Tuesday that they are conducting a one-day hunger strike in solidarity with Al-Isawi and his comrades. Political detainees in Israel announced that they will escalate their protest move if their demands are not met. Abd al-Fattah Khalil is from the Palestinian Political Prisoner Society in Bethlehem.
The hunger strike protest actions by the political detainees are in preparation for a general open-ended hunger strike expected to take place soon due to the ongoing attacks by the Israeli Prisons Administration on the prisoners and due to long-time hunger strikers who are in danger of being harmed.
For IMEMC News, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Laura Kussman, and Kristen Yount. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, more talk radio with Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. At 9, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick discusses how gun proponents whip up fears of crime, and Alan Weider interviews radical singer-songwriter David Drovix. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with author and activist Sandra Steingraber about why fracking is not a sustainable solution to our energy needs. At 11 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall speaks with Linda Drock about developing healthy food environments for incarcerated women at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Oregon. And at 11:30, Ralph Colson interviews John Hodgman, The Daily Show's resident expert. They'll talk about his upcoming event at Portland's Baghdad Theater, the challenges of combining writing, acting, and comedy, and his views on news issues, such as the economy, the budget, and sequestration. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. You make it all happen. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, a new series, Women, Money, and Empowerment, Taking Responsibility for Finances, Taking Control of Destiny. Have a great weekend. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the recent re-election of Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa, at least in the eyes of the U.S. media, signals the further entrenching of a bad left government in Latin America. What does this mean for U.S. reporting and